From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Is technology changing how we think? Or rather, is technology finally catching on to how we think? Today's interview suggests that perhaps both may be true. David Sheff is the author of Game Over, Nintendo Zapped an American Industry, Captured Your Dollars, and Enslaved Your Children. We look into why Nintendo games have such a mesmerizing hold on our youth, and just what is known about how it affects behavior. Later, I'll talk with Bart Kosko, a professor at the University of Southern California. His article on fuzzy logic appeared in the July issue of Scientific American. Dr. Kosko discusses how to make technology reflect how we think. In Game Over, David Sheff writes about the sudden and massive expansion of the video games industry and the impact which it has had in both the American economy and American society. I asked David what motivated him to write this book.
I have a son who is now 11, and when we first got the Nintendo system into our home, he was only about 5 or 6. And whereas the trend of the moment would come into the house, it would soon disappear. But this one didn't go away. He and his friends just got more and more immersed in video games, and he got more phone calls at night from friends calling up to ask for secret tips and to boast about getting to sort of a new world, or to ask him, you know, how do you kill the mini boss on level 14 of Super Mario 3 or something. And then I picked up the paper one day and saw that a survey had been done of American children, which concluded that more of them now recognize Nintendo's mascot Super Mario than recognize Mickey Mouse. And to me, that said something is going on and something dramatic is going on. And most people, at least most adults that I knew, had no idea. And so that caused me to look closer.
What could be bigger than Mickey Mouse?
That's right.
Well, in the early 80s, there were a number of American firms who were making a killing in video games. What happened? How did we get to Nintendo?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story. Nintendo is a 100-and-some-odd-year-old company, but they were making playing cards for all those years, a really sort of beautiful and ancient game called Hanafuda that started out when craftsmen would paint images on shells and then it converted into a playing card game. When here in the 70s, the video game industry was really born. The first commercial video game was created by Nolan Bushnell, who founded Atari, and other American companies followed him into the business, Coleco and Mattel. And so in the early 1980s, there was an industry that grew to about $2.5 billion, maybe a little more than that. But they did a lot of things wrong. There were so many bad management decisions that it's sort of astounding. First of all, there was a lot of really young people at these companies that made an enormous amount of money. And so people like Bushnell and some of his cronies were off flying around on their own Learjets, entertaining movie stars and hanging out in restaurants in Paris instead of minding the store. And then Atari was sold to Warner Communications, a big, big conglomerate, who didn't have any idea how to sell a product to young boys, which is really the driving force of this market, of this whole world of video games. And they did a lot of stupid things. They came out with games that were, first of all, terrible. They made a game, for instance, based on the movie E.T. that was incomprehensible. And not only was it a terrible game and boring, which is the kiss of death for a video game, but they produced more of the games, of the E.T. games, than were systems out there in the market. So it was just, it was impossible, absolutely impossible to sell all that they'd made. And so they just didn't know what they were doing. And the industry went from a multi-billion dollar industry to almost disappearing by about 1980, end of 1982, about 1983. There was nothing, it was in shambles. There was too many companies, software companies, retailers who'd lost enormous amounts of money. And so nobody wanted to touch video games with a 10-foot pole when Nintendo a few years later came in and decided to ignore them all.
After the Atari crash, Nintendo dissociated itself from video games to reapproach those toy stores and whoever was selling them. And the term video game was replaced by entertainment system, and game cartridge became a game pack. And yet all those original terms are still with us.
Well, that was the big challenge at first for Nintendo, was to disassociate themselves from the video game industry. But very quickly, video games had a new life, and it was people forgot about the old generation of games, because Nintendo came in with technology that was superior, and especially software that was superior. The original Nintendo games that hit America, for instance, the first Super Mario Brothers game and the Legend of Zelda and Metroid, were a revelation, something we'd never seen before. It really showed the promise of these machines that never had lived up to their promise before. The original video games, anybody who of a certain generation probably remembers Pong and some of its and some of the shooting games that followed it, Tank and some of those, and they were compelling because they were new, but they got old pretty fast. Whereas these new games came in and they had so much more depth, and they had so much more creativity in them, and there was so much more imagination in them, that in some ways it was analogous, I think, to reading a really great book. And to sort of dive into The Legend of Zelda was a new experience for people. And so I think that the buzz began, and when it began, the old Atari days were almost forgotten, and there was a new movement and a new industry, and so video game machines and cartridges and all the old stuff not only came back, but flourished. And pretty soon, kids who had been drawn in because of Super Mario and Zelda and Donkey Kong and things like that were talking about how many bytes their system had and how many megabytes their cartridges had. So the technology sort of slipped in through the popular culture.
I'm old enough to remember our family's first television. And when my sister grew up, she grew up routinely watching television. And today kids watch TV and the VCR and they play Nintendo. How's this changing their lives?
Well, first of all, it is changing their lives. It's changing them dramatically. TV has been around long enough to know, for us to know, that that it has an enormous impact on the culture. I mean, it's just, you know, it can't be overstated. It affects the way we think. It affects the way we relate to one another. It affects the way we consume. It affects the way that our children learn and grow. And video games, in some ways, and certainly psychologists have corroborated this, have more of an impact than television because of the attention that's required is so much greater. There are other things going on, possible to go on in someone's brain when they're watching television, but when you're playing a video game as intently as these games are played by design, nothing else is going on. And because of that sort of linear thinking that's going on, first of all, there's a whole world that's being excluded to kids. When you think about kids going to school for 8 hours a day or whatever it is, or 7 hours a day, and then perhaps they have an hour of homework, and then there's, you know, perhaps a meal thrown in there, there's not that much time. Yet studies I've seen have shown that kids are playing video games sometimes 3 and 4 hours a night on school nights, and sometimes more than that. And some families who would never imagine letting their kids watch TV for that much time set no limits when it comes to video game playing. So kids are playing, in some cases, 6, 7, 8 hours a day. And that much of anything is having an impact, partly just because of what else isn't being done, the social interaction that's not being done, the thinking, the creative play that's not being done. But it also has its own impact that's just specific to this medium. And some of the really repetitive games, for instance, cause the brain almost, as psychologists explained it to me in sort of very simple terms, it almost causes the brain to shut down. It goes into sort of a repetitive loop. And it's problematic because some of the results are really high levels of anxiety, increased frustration among kids. These things spill off into their relationships with their siblings, into school, into their relationships with the parents. And the reason that I think that a lot of kids are getting away with playing as much as they are is because video games are so new. And the studies haven't been done to prove what, to me, the anecdotal evidence proves conclusively, that these things have an enormous amount of power in kids' lives. Kids mimic what they see on the screens in their play. It affects the way that they perceive problems. A psychologist on a panel was talking about violence in video games, and he was saying that among older children, the violence in video games may not be that significant. Kids can tell the difference between real violence and cartoon violence. But in much younger children, he's done studies with kids who play a lot of video games against a control group of kids who are just watching television and doing other normal, in quotes, kid activities. And the kids who are playing a lot of video games will come to a problem, to the same problem as these other kids, and confront it with a very, very limited amount of creativity. For instance, a boy has an apple, and the other child wants the apple. What's the child going to do? Well, the control group of kids will come up with an enormous amount of possibilities. Can I have a bite of the apple? Can I have half the apple? Can I trade you something for the apple? When you're finished with having some of the apple, can I have the rest of it? These kids who have been playing video games a lot will come up with two or three options. Take the apple, give up, or maybe something else. But that's a fundamental difference in the way that these kids are being shaped, and it's going to affect them in everything. Besides all the other effects of video games, there's something interesting that's going on in that it's the first time in history, as far as I can tell, where a product that was geared just to children cost so much money. It used to be that the product that was a hot thing for Christmas might be the new G.I. Joe or Barbie or something, or maybe a new board game or something like that. So parents were out maybe $20 or something. And maybe once in a childhood would come along the year of the bicycle, which maybe was $100 or something like that. But video game systems cost $100 each now, minimum, just to get in. And then the games cost about $50, and now they're getting up to about $75 each. So Nintendo has said that in the average life of owning a Nintendo system, a family will buy about 12 or 13 games. And so simple math on that is that we're talking about every family, before they throw that system away and invest in a new system for even more money, they're talking about spending $500 or $600.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is David Sheff. He is author of the book Game Over, Nintendo Zapped an American Industry, Captured Your Dollars, and Enslaved Your Children. What I find fascinating about what you just said is that while they're interacting and they're figuring out different ways through these mazes, the options that you have in a video game are those options provided to you by whoever wrote the game.
That's right. The game companies will tell you that video games are better than television because they're interactive. But is interactivity, by definition, a good thing? Certainly there are some games that are creative and open to different possibilities, and it does involve children thinking. It sometimes involves them running to the bookshelf, God forbid, to pick up an encyclopedia or something, a book. That's right. And at their best, and certainly there are better computer games than video games because they do more, and they're not competing for the same kind of attention, and so they can be slower and they can involve a lot more levels of thought. But in slam bang, duke 'em out or shoot 'em out or whatever the most popular video games are, there really isn't much going on in terms of interactivity. So the interactivity that's going on is stimulus response at such a quick pace that there's no time in that loop for any kind of thinking or any kind of reflection, and there aren't choices. As you say, what children are doing, if they're going to succeed, is they're going to do what the programmer wants them to do. So that means that's someone else's creativity, it's not their own. And whereas a book provides a certain kind of stimulation, in a sense, a programmer's, an author's input, what's done with that then is left to the child's imagination, and pictures are created in the mind, emotions are created. With video games, the only images that are created are the ones that are presented to you, and so it's on all levels. And you know, there aren't emotions in video games. That doesn't mean there can't be, but certainly in the current generation of games, it's rare.
My boys, when you're got one of the versions of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and that was one of my first experiences, just watching them play it. And I was pretty amazed because the turtles are doing all these kinds of things, and the girl in it, all April got to do was be saved. I mean, it was indignant. You know, you were saying earlier, most of these games are oriented toward boys. Is that still the case?
It is the case, and it's it causes a whole other series of problems. What sells video games is more than anything else these companies can do, more than advertising and more than any other factor, is coolness. And what becomes cool for younger kids is what's cool for older kids, and what's cool for older kids becomes what's cool for the even older kids, the teenage kids, who are playing video games in arcades. And in arcades, you can walk into arcades, and if there are girls there, they're looking over the boys' shoulders, unfortunately, and almost always. I mean, there certainly are some girl players who are great and devoted, but it's a small number. And as a result, girls are not only are they left out of whatever education is going on here, and maybe it's a good thing for them, but they're also it's really not just reinforcing, but creating some new stereotypes. First of all, as you say, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but I could also list about 100 other games that are about saving a girl in distress, and some of them are far, far more brutal than even the worst of television. There's a new game called Night Trap, in which girls are not just kidnapped, but they're tortured. They're chained up against a wall, and drills are sort of slowly injected into their necks and things like that. I mean, it's pretty brutal and pretty, it's pretty incredible. And so in terms of reinforcing all the stereotypes that we're, trying to do something about, I mean, these games are back to the dark ages. The other thing is that in a lot of games, girls are present in Street Fighter II, which was the most popular selling game last year, the biggest selling game last year. There's one girl fighter, but mostly the game is about these big, brutal guys bashing each other, basically. And when you get good, you can get your guy to jump on his opponent's head and start biting his skull until blood starts spurting out. And
how attractive.
It's great. But the girls in the game are sitting on the sidelines wearing their bikinis, and they're sort of dancing and cheering the guys on. And so the companies all of a sudden saw, well, wait a second, we've pretty much saturated the market of boys out there, so how are we going to win over more girls? And so they've actually been going after girls in the last couple of years, and Nintendo's fastest-growing market segment right now are girls, and they've done it by pushing some of the less violent games, some of the puzzle games and things like that, and also sort of insultingly coming out with games that are, like a bad knockoff of Barbie doll in video game form, or My Little Pony, The Little Mermaid is now a video game, and things like that, designed to go after girls. It's a pretty callous marketing decision, and it's not being done because somebody has come up with this great, inspiring sort of creative program that also happens to appeal to girls. It's being done because there are more dollars to be made.
My guest today is David Sheff, author of Game Over, a book about Nintendo, the company itself, and its impact on America. I'm Myra Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Let's turn for a little bit to, as you said, dollars to be made, to the business end of Nintendo. One of the keys to Nintendo's success had been the control of both the system and the games themselves. How did that work?
Yeah, it is the sole reason that Nintendo makes more money than almost any other company you can think of, more money than Apple or Microsoft or all the movie studios combined, or some of the other, I sort of rattled off in the book a lot of statistics, because it is a new way to tackle an industry. It is not just selling the hardware, but it is completely controlling the software. It is as if one company was selling VCRs, but also either selling or controlling the rental of every movie that played on them. The VCR business right now is about an $11 billion a year industry, and it's as if one company was controlling that whole thing. In computers, there's a different model. If I want to go out and start a company and create a piece of software that would run on a Macintosh computer or on an IBM PC, I can do that. If I wanted to make a video game that would play on Nintendo's system, or perhaps the Sega system, which is Nintendo's big competitor, I couldn't do it. There is proprietary technology in those systems that stops me from doing it. And secondly, there are all kinds of licensing agreements that are required. Because the industry has been set up that way, Nintendo is, not only are they making an enormous amount of money, in fact, I think it was over $1.6 billion last year in profits, but also they are dictating the businesses of other companies. If you want to work with Nintendo, you play by their rules. They tell you which games you can produce, how many games you can produce, how you can market their games. The benefit is sizable, too. You have a marketplace that is insatiable. There are about 35 million Nintendo systems in American homes right now, and so a lot of software companies are making a lot of money. But it also means that a lot of smaller software companies can't get in because it costs so much to get in. You have to not only pay licensing fees and all, but you have to buy technology from Nintendo, which means you have to actually buy chips, computer chips, to so that your cartridges can play in the Nintendo machine. And that means that Nintendo is making money coming and going. And as a result, there's a lot of companies that have been frustrated in trying to get involved in that industry.
Still, there have been a number of lawsuits which might have broken Nintendo's hold on the market, but didn't. Tell us what happened there.
Nintendo has been almost been unbelievable how they've managed to sort of walk the line of what is acceptable business practice in America. They have been investigated by the Federal Trade Commission and by the Justice Department and by different Congress people. They've been sued by a dozen companies at least, probably more. There have been a couple examples of cases where Nintendo has lost, but very, very few. Almost always, Nintendo manages to get through these things unscathed, and it's a testament to how smart they are. They cover all their bases, and they do a good job they've succeeded because of a number of things. One of them is because they came in with a great product. Secondly, they are marketers par excellence. I mean, they have shaken up not just marketing of video or games or computers in America, but any company. They have they're amazing in the way that they've done their marketing. They cover all bases. But they also have had a control on the industry that is pretty unusual. And that's where they've been criticized, and that's where they've been accused of operating a monopoly and accused of restraining other people's business. But they've always walked through these things almost, as I said, unscathed. And some of it is a testament to the way that people have attacked them. For instance, the original Atari ended up breaking up into a lot of little companies, and one of them, Atari Games, a software company, decided to go after Nintendo, and after originally gaining a license, they tried to break the Nintendo stronghold by illegally copying Nintendo's some of its copyrighted technology. If they had done that legally, and if they had done it on their own without stealing secrets, essentially, then they probably would have won a major lawsuit against Nintendo, but they didn't. The judge found, and there was lots of evidence to prove, that Atari Games had literally stolen copyright that allowed their games to work on the Nintendo machine. So they didn't have a chance in their suit. The Federal Trade Commission ended up, in one of their investigations of Nintendo, was for price fixing. And there was a lot of occasions where Nintendo representatives, even if it wasn't a corporate policy, there were Nintendo representatives who were engaging in some form of price fixing. People told me stories that I recount in the book. But after a year-long investigation against Nintendo, the FTC ended up settling with Nintendo. And so Nintendo never had to admit that they were guilty. And as penance for this supposed price fixing, or for whatever they didn't do, or whatever they never had to admit that they were doing, they had to send out to all their customers $5 coupons, so that essentially they send out 20 million at the time, perhaps, coupons good for $5 off your next purchase of a Nintendo game. So as penalty for doing something that you're not supposed to do in this country, they were forced, in quotes, to do this great marketing scheme. So kids all over the country took their $5 coupon and went down to the store, bought a $50 Nintendo game, they got $5 off, and Nintendo still made money.
Ooh, hit me again.
That's
Give
right.
me another penalty.
That's right, exactly.
I was fascinated when I read about Nintendo Power Magazine and some of the other cross promotions with Pepsi and Tide laundry detergent and McDonald's and a 30-city Nintendo Power Fest. What are all these things?
It's part of the Nintendo marketing loop, which leaves no stone unturned. These guys sat around and they talked about that, and they talked about it and talked about it, and they interviewed kids, and they interviewed toy store owners, and they spent an enormous amount of time researching things before they launched their business here. They did things like, video games sort of had a bad image because they were kind of tied to video games and arcades and kind of tied to pool tables. And so there was something a little bit racy about them, and so they weren't sure that parents were going to welcome them into their homes. So they tied to products like Tide and Pepsi and sort of all-American products, and pretty soon when you bought a McDonald's Happy Meal or something like that, you got Nintendo characters inside, which of course the kids wanted. So kids were inundated with Nintendo, and there were Nintendo breakfast cereals and Nintendo bed sheets, and it goes down the line. Nintendo Magazine, Nintendo Power it's called, became the biggest circulation magazine for children, a magazine that came out monthly that kids paid for, that became a Bible for kids because it was the key to winning some of the tough Nintendo games. It told you how to beat Morton Koopa Jr. or how to kill Wart or how to get through the seventh level of The Legend of Zelda when you just couldn't figure out how to do battle with one of the warriors there or something like that. So this magazine, teachers told me this, that kids who would not read a page of schoolwork were poring over every single word of Nintendo Power magazine. Similar to Nintendo Power, there are the Nintendo game counselors. When you get really stuck and you can't figure out something in a game, even with the magazine, you call Seattle. They've got about 300 to 500, I think it is, guys sitting around in front of computer terminals and Nintendo games whose job it is to do nothing but play games and to give kids tips on how to play. So a child will be stuck and he'll call up Nintendo and they'll have a conversation with these game counselors, and the game counselors will find out from the kids what they like and what they don't like, and that information will be filtered into their R&D divisions, and they'll also tell the kids, well, wait till you see the sequel to this game. Super Mario World is coming out soon, and it's playable on the new 16-bit Nintendo system, which has three dimensions and it's got far better graphics, and pretty soon the frenzy that's anticipating the next game is unbelievable.
So Nintendo publishes Nintendo Power Magazine.
Yep. They publish the magazine and use their database of Nintendo buyers. When you buy a Nintendo system, in order to get a free copy of Nintendo Power Magazine, you turn in a warranty card. And once they've got your name on their mailing list, then you are theirs. the other half of Nintendo Power Magazine is nothing but a promotion for new Nintendo games. So kids were paying for this magazine that would help them get through the games, and then the rest of the magazine was devoted to selling them the next game. So the next game would come out, and there was this enormous audience. So video games came out, and when Nintendo came out in 1985 in America, they sold for about 1 million systems within the first year and a half, I think it was, or maybe it was 2 years. Then they sold 5 million within the year after that. After that, they'd sold 20 million. By 1990, they'd sold about 30 million systems. Video games would come in to the marketplace, and there was such demand that a successful game would sell 500,000, but a really successful game would sell 1 million, 2, 3 million copies. Super Mario Brothers 3, the third sequel to Super Mario, sold 7 million copies in America alone. Overall, it sold about 11 million copies, and every one of those games cost about $50 each. So I compared it to the movie business. No movie except for E.T. has grossed as much as Super Mario 3. That's what is at stake, and that's the way they did it. They did it by leaving no stone unturned, as I said.
My guest today has been David Sheff. He is author of the book Game Over, Nintendo Zapped an American Industry, Captured Your Dollars, and Enslaved Your Children. It's published by Random House. You are listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. As humans, we're all thinking beings. just how much do we understand that process? And how much does the society we live in affect our definition of what thinking is? Dr. Bart Kosko holds degrees in philosophy, mathematics, and engineering, and is author of the book Fuzzy Thinking, The New Science of Fuzzy Logic. I asked him how Western philosophy has shaped scientific thinking.
It works like this. The language of science is math, and the structure of that math is logic. And that logic was first codified by the Western philosopher Aristotle about 2,300 years ago. And the essence of that logic is the black and the white, either or, what Aristotle called the law of excluded middle. The sky is either blue or not blue. And that's at the heart of modern mathematics, which is the language and methodology of science. So the worst thing that can happen is A and not A, the sky that's both blue and not blue, a contradiction. And that's at the essence of Eastern-type thinking.
Now, in your book, you talk about the relation of Aristotle and that type of thinking and the Buddha and their relationship to fuzzy logic.
You know, it works like this. At the heart of Aristotelian thinking, again, is the black and the white. And at the heart of Eastern or Buddhist or Lhotse-type Taoist thinking is the gray. And logically speaking, Aristotle, again, would say that the sky is either blue or not blue, whereas the Buddha or the Taoism would say the sky is both blue and not blue. So A and not A versus A or not A. And it turns out, in a mathematical sense, that this extreme either-or black-white stuff does hold, but only as a limiting case of the shades of gray. So in some sense, the more general case is this, call it the Eastern logic approach of the pink rose that's both red and not red, and only in the very extreme case is it all red or not.
So tell us now that we know that things aren't quite so crisp as we'd like them to be, or we have been striving for them to be. Tell us now, what's fuzzy logic, and where do we see it in our lives?
Fuzzy logic is a new branch of machine intelligence that tries to make computers think like people think, and it tries to do that by getting them to work with sloppy, common-sense terms. For example, a fuzzy air conditioner might have a rule in it of the form, if the air is cool, then turn the air conditioner down a little. And another rule, if the air is warm, then turn it up a little. And a notion like cool air is fuzzy, because all air is cool to some degree and at the same time not cool to some degree. And likewise, a motor command like turn down the motor a little is a fuzzy concept. All commands are little to some degree and not little at the same time. So what a fuzzy system does, it takes a lot of these rules of the form, if something, then something, and converts inputs to outputs. And that's a way we can control machines, in effect, make them smarter. So the net effect of fuzzy logic at the appliance level is to up the machine IQ, or up the mic of the appliance.
Now, there's been some negative reaction to the concept of fuzzy logic over the years, and I quote from your book Professor William Cahan of the University of California at Berkeley, and he says, "Fuzzy theory is wrong and pernicious. What we need is more logical thinking, not less. The danger of fuzzy logic is that it will encourage the sort of imprecise thinking that has brought us so much trouble. Fuzzy logic is the cocaine of science." What is all this upset about?
Well, I call that the binary reflex. Again, if you're trained in science, you've been taught that the hallmark of scientific reasoning is precision. And the hallmark example of that is mathematical reasoning, which is purely black and white. The number two is either even or not. Then to come along in the midst of that and say the world is gray, but science is black and white, and we need to make science gray too, is something of an upset. It's upsetting the apple cart in a very deep way. Now, adopting a black and white logic is not itself a logical act. It's a cultural act. It's a system-level thing. In other words, you accept as a package deal one way of reasoning, but there's no formal reason for doing that. It's not something you prove mathematically, just do it. So if you've been trained that way, and if your instructors were trained that way, and so on, all the way back to Aristotle, this just seems utterly outrageous. So a claim to the fact that fuzzy logic is a cocaine of science is just what I think you would expect to hear from the status quo, and it's been the case. So the way it used to work is, once you would talk about fuzzy logic, and the ancient Greeks did in many forms of paradoxes, for example, am I bald or not? No, I pluck out a hair. Am I bald or not? No. And I keep plucking hairs, I never find that one hair that takes me from not bald to bald. But in those days, it was just dismissed as an anomaly of language. At the turn of this century, Bertrand Russell tried to reduce mathematics to logic in a book called Principia Mathematica, and failed when he found these same Greek paradoxes in the very structure of math. He used the example of a barber. There's a barber in a town who's a man and shaves all and only those men who don't shave themselves. So who shaves the barber? If he shaves himself, he doesn't. And if he doesn't, he does. And this is a version of the old Greek paradox of the liar. There's a liar from Crete who says that all Cretans are liars. Is he lying or not? If he lies, he doesn't. If he doesn't, he does. So you seem to have thing and not thing, A and not A at the same time. This stopped Russell and others in their tracks and opened the door, in effect, to fuzzy logic. Let the gray cat out of the black and white bag. And so, Moira, as time progressed, the mathematical theory in this century of fuzzy logic has been developed, but the attack, the criticism of it, then, well, what can you do with it? No applications. And then when, from Japan, the first applications began to roll in, the response was different. Interesting applications, but no theory. This is really just black and white reasoning or probability in disguise. And now we have, as time has passed, sort of a 1-2 punch. We have both the new theory, the mathematical theory of fuzzy logic, and several billions of dollars a year in fuzzy smart products coming from Japan and Korea.
Now, what are we seeing that's fuzzy logic oriented or driven?
You have to understand that Japan and Korea produce about 80 to 90% of the world's consumer electronics gadgets. And most of those have in them a microprocessor, a small computer chip. So in effect, what's happened is we've had a management reorganization at the chip level. Rather than building a new company, we've just reorganized. In other words, we've just reprogrammed the chip. And so in that way, taking advantage of new sensor technology, we have fuzzy washing machines, camcorders, TVs, about every component of a car that you could possibly control, from the steering to braking to throttle control to fuel injection, suspension. Mitsubishi has an omnibus fuzzy system. And even the GM Saturn uses a fuzzy transmission in the United States. Several hundred gadgets like that have been put under fuzzy control.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Bart Kosko. He is a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Southern California, and he's author of the new book, Fuzzy Thinking, The New Science of Fuzzy Logic. Bart, I have to say that it was important for me to read about fuzzy logic, which I have done before, and to think about fuzzy thinking at the same time. It's easier for me to think in terms of sort of fuzzy language and how we all talk to each other. You say, well, is the soup done? And it's like, well, maybe, you know, it's kind of, you know, is it warm enough for you? And you're used to that in your everyday life. When you go to program something on a computer or do some scientific project where you're trying to perform something, I suddenly get into a different mental mode, whether that's from my training or Western civilization, and I say, okay, we're going to reduce this to ones and zeros. You know, where's the cut? Where isn't the cut? And that's sort of been the methodology that we had. But when I start looking at it in terms of fuzzy thinking and where that is in my life and fuzzy language, it seems easier to look at the logic of it, of fuzzy logic.
Fuzzy thinking is the view that everything is a matter of degree. Fuzzy logic is the application of that fuzzy principle to science and math. So, for example, you can apply it outside of science and math to societal issues, worldviews, and the like. And I think in general, Moira, you brought up a duality that we all have between thought and action. Thought, I think, is inherently fuzzy. Action tends to be decisive, bivalent, all or none. For example, a jury. We don't accept a verdict of 80% guilty. We want the verdict to be all or none, where in fact maybe only 80% of the jurors really agreed, or a given juror only felt 80% confident of his or her decision. The candidate gets elected all or none. Everything gets rounded off for us, and that helps us get by. And likewise, at the computer level, right down to the chip level and the flow of electrons, the circuit or gate is either on or off. It's either a string of one or zeros. And that's a very efficient way to work with systems. On the other hand, it's not very accurate. If we say that the glass is only empty or full, you know, we leave out all these spectrums in between when it's partially full, and it completely breaks down when the cup is exactly half full because we can't round that off.
Why is it important that anyone other than scientists know about fuzzy logic?
I think it's important for several reasons. One example, if you think about the fuzzy principle, everything's a matter of degree in terms of our binary reflex of wanting to put people into groups, I think this explains what I'd call the logic of racism, of discrimination. We just love to put people into groups. You're white, or you're black, you're left, you're right, you're Democrat, Republican, you hold this view, you're pro or anti-abortion, always falsifying, always putting people in pigeonholes. Whereas the fuzzy view is much more tolerant. You are left and right, Democrat and Republic. You, in effect, hold all views to some degree and don't hold them to some degree. And I think that's a very healthy thing.
In your article in the July 1993 issue of Scientific American, you say, the Achilles heel of a fuzzy system is its rules. What do you mean by that?
Is its rules. In other words, a fuzzy system is a set of fuzzy rules of the form, if the air is cool and turn down the air conditioner a little, that turns inputs into outputs. The question is, where do you get the rules? And the first approximation, you ask an expert, in this case, someone who controls an air conditioner. For example, in the city of Sendai, a city north of Tokyo, Hitachi developed about 60 fuzzy rules in conversations with experts and used that to control the subway. And now it completely runs the subway and outperforms the best humans and the best automatic controllers. The humans still run the subway, but in non-peak hours to keep up their skills. But what if there aren't experts to ask? Sometimes they're not, or the experts are unreliable. What you want to do in that case is have something that's data-driven that can watch an expert behave. For example, suppose you ask Itzhak Perlman how he plays the violin, how he converts the notes on the page to vibrations of the string. He could give you an answer, but it's not going to be the kind of answer you could program in a computer, fuzzy or not. So we want to have systems that learn from example, like people do, and we have those. These are called neural systems. And a neural fuzzy system is sort of the frontier of the technology where the neural system recognizes patterns, like cool air, and then associates them into fuzzy rules, like if the air is cool, turn down the air conditioner a little. So, for example, there's a successful neural system on the market that can tell a good pap smear from a bad pap smear. But nobody knows how to program a computer to do that. In other words, we don't know how to draw the mathematical line between good and bad pap smear. So the idea is this. Modern computers are very good at crunching numbers. They're like high-speed adding machines. They're not good at all at recognizing patterns. They can't recognize your face in an image, for example. We just don't know how to explain that to a computer. People are great at that. Brains are great at pattern recognition. And these neural systems are pattern recognizers. And those patterns are inherently fuzzy. The boundaries are always vague. So the new neural fuzzy systems watch an expert behave and figure out the rules. A case in point is backing up a truck and a trailer rig in a parking lot to a loading dock. Now, experts do this all the time, but right now there's no known set of equations to back up a truck from any, say, jackknife configuration to the loading dock. It may exist, but we just don't know that. And this is the real advance of fuzzy systems, that they can model a system. Now, a system, again, is anything that turns inputs into outputs. And traditionally in science, you had to come up with some equations. And how do you come up with those? You guess at them. And the fact is we guess very poorly. The guesses are very simple. The world's very complicated. If you have data, though, if you have experts who can actually back up the truck and trailer, and of course we do, you can just use that data, and the system will automatically figure out the implicit rules the experts are using. That's the advance, that as we paint pictures of the universe, we don't have to rely upon human psychology to come up with the equations. There just aren't enough Einsteins around to do that. We can be more data-driven. And the new theorems show that, in theory, you could replace all the textbooks and all the equations with fuzzy systems. Could you do it in practice? No, because we don't know the fuzzy rules. So that's why the Achilles heel of a fuzzy system is always its rules, how we come up with the knowledge and how we tune it.
So a fuzzy system, first of all, can only be as smart as the rules that are put into it.
Yes.
So if your rule is, if it's above 72 degrees, it's hot, and if it's below 72 degrees, it's cold, there's a pretty, that's a not very smart system, right?
Right. It's a very simplistic system, and the result will tend to be overshoot, undershoot. You'll bounce around this phenomenon we all experience driving the car, the air conditioner, or at home. It's always too hot, too cold. It fluctuates about the point. The way a fuzzy system works is it has lots of rules with these vague fuzzy sets, and they all tend to fire or activate to some degree at any given moment. And the system takes an average of all these, and it gives a nice, smooth response. So in the case of that Sendai subway system, the fuzzy system is smoother at braking and accelerating and decelerating than the best humans are, and precisely for this reason, and certainly better than the best automatic control system. These are equation-based systems. Someone tried to guess at the equations of braking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very rough approximation. It's always very jerky.
Now, the second part of what I think you were saying is that rather than having to come up with these rules themselves, saying first this, then this, then this, we can actually build systems that observe the behavior of experts.
Yes.
And get better. For instance, in the braking, one could see how a train braked by taking sensors and seeing how a human brakes the train. And then one could start to observe that feedback over time and come with a very smooth mechanism that a human couldn't react to in the kinds of reaction times it has. Is that what we're talking
about?
That's
the right idea. You learn from example, and you learn the patterns of the expert. Case in point is Sharp has a neural fuzzy refrigerator coming out of Japan, and the neural system learns your patterns of opening the door, refrigerator door, how long you tend to open it, what time of day, how long you stand there, and so forth, and then uses that knowledge to tune its fuzzy rules more appropriately to your control, in other words, to adapt it to you. Another system under development is a neural fuzzy air conditioner in a car. Some more, you know, you may mean something different by cool than I mean by it. And we sit down and have some voice interaction, say, no, that's not, it's too cool, not quite cool enough, and so on. And you tune the system your way, then when I drive the car, I tune it my way. So it's user-dependent. It adapts to the individual. It's tuning the fuzzy sets, the fuzzy rules.
So the old, I knew you drove my car because you changed the mirror, will now be...
You got it.
I knew you drove my car because it's too hot.
It's too hot. You tune the fuzzy brain of the thing, absolutely.
I like it. My guest today is Bart Kosko, author of Fuzzy Thinking, a new book which includes the computer science definition of fuzzy logic, but also examines its roots in Eastern and Western philosophy. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. When you intone the reader, don't confuse science with the scientists, you say the product of science is knowledge, and the product of scientists is reputation.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Henry Kissinger put it best. He said, the reason academic politics are so ugly is because there's so little to fight for. What is it that a professor does? Besides the teaching that most people think of, that's really not it. The game of science is a game of reputation. You know, you see that with physicists and winning Nobel Prizes. In engineering, for example, there are no Nobel Prizes given. It's more patent-based and honor-based in terms of technical publications. But that's a very intangible quantity. It's very much an ego quantity. I think of the product of scientists, at least hard scientists and engineers, as just a little dab of math, and wrapped around that is a tremendous amount of ego. And so when a new order comes along, a truly new idea like fuzzy logic that not just upsets the current thinking, but in effect a whole tradition of the Western civilization, you get a very, very emotional response. Max Planck, the founder of quantum mechanics, said that the way new ideas succeed in science is not that you simply persuade the opposition, they wake up and see the light, but rather that the old guard simply dies off, and in time a new generation comes along to whom the ideas are familiar and trivial. And that's been the experience, I think, of fuzzy logic and many other new ideas.
What is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and how does it relate to fuzzy logic?
Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is a trade-off between two quantities. One example is between the speed and the position of a car if you're driving in one lane in one direction. Usually it's given an example of an electron. So in other words, if the electron is moving very fast and you know how fast it's moving, you won't know with certainty where it is. So in the car analogy, then if you went fast enough, you would know where you were on the freeway. And if you did know where you were on the freeway, you wouldn't know how fast you were going. You couldn't, in effect, trust your speedometer. Now, it turns out in science that there are several of these uncertainty principles between what are called conjugate variables, not just between position and momentum in that case, but also in physics between time and energy and other things. Now, in engineering, right now as we speak, we're using another uncertainty principle between the time and frequency of a signal. This is operative on a radio transmission. It's operative every time you look at TV. It means there are limits to knowledge. And so when Heisenberg in the 1920s first found this at the quantum level, and at the same time H.L. Hartley and others at Bell Labs found it at the information theory level, it shook the world and told the world that there are limits to knowledge, that you'll never have total certainty even if all the facts were in. And in many ways that opened up science to fuzzy logic or multivalued logic. Heisenberg himself and others did explore multivalued logics, and John von Neumann and several other quantum theorists of different kinds of logics. But the idea was that you'll never have certainty. So the first thing they did is say the statements are not just true or false. They're either true, false, or indeterminate. And then indeterminacy itself took on degrees. So you had the whole continuous spectrum of fuzzy values.
So let me see if I understand this. Because we can't be absolutely certain about many things, we can't just write out a formula, write out an equation, the way we like to program our computers.
Yes.
And that's why fuzzy logic then plays a role. It can adapt to that uncertainty.
Well, that's not quite the point. The historical point was we thought Aristotle's logic was right, was sufficient. And if you knew all the facts, you could completely predict the future, for example. Now, what the quantum uncertainty principle showed was even if you knew everything you could possibly know about an electron, you still wouldn't know all you could know about it. In other words, if you knew how fast it was going, you didn't know where it was, and vice versa. And there are many other properties that if you knew one, you wouldn't know the other. And that was, according to the theory, and that theory is still in place, that was the limits of our knowledge. So that made people doubt that you could say it was true, that the electron was going at such and such speed. It wasn't that it was true or false. It was that it was true or false to some degree. It was indeterminate. So that got people to doubt the old assumption of black-white reasoning.
American students are more familiar with mathematics and Western philosophy, if they're familiar with any philosophy at all.
Right.
Do they have difficulty grasping fuzzy logic?
I haven't found that. I teach a class where we have a course project. We develop a neural fuzzy gadget or system. You can simulate it, build a real thing, whatever you like, and the winner gets usually a $1,000 prize, money put up by some firm. This year it's put up by Motorola, and they're runner-up prizes, and then we have a video countdown from previous winners and so forth. I find students can do this very easily. It turns out it's very easy to use fuzzy logic. Now, the mathematics behind it can be complicated, but you don't need to know any of that to actually build a fuzzy system, and you certainly don't need any of that to use a fuzzy gadget. So I have found the response has been very enthusiastic, and in fact, the ideas, people are very enthusiastic to it, something new. If you go back to that other issue about the East and the West and our knowledge of Eastern philosophy, you know, why is it that there's a yin-yang symbol on the flag of South Korea? And why is it that most of your listeners probably could not name five Eastern books if asked? And when was the last time, Moira, that you saw a movie about the Buddha?
I don't know if I've ever seen a movie
about
the Buddha.
I don't think you have. I say that because, one, you probably haven't seen one, and two, Bernardo Bertolucci, the director of The Last Emperor, has just shot a big epic called The Little Buddha, and will be out, I believe, in December. So the point is, we in the West really have very little knowledge of Eastern culture. It's stereotypical, racial stereotypes. We think of chopsticks and rice bowls and body types and these sorts of things. But at the level of ideas, you know, why is it that there's a yin-yang symbol on the flag of South Korea? The yin-yang symbol, the balanced opposites, the black and the white, as opposed to Aristotle's version of that, which would be all black or all white in some sense. And I think the reason is at the heart of Eastern belief system, from Zen Buddhism to Taoism, in fact, to many others, is a tolerance of opposites, the unity of opposites, the balance of the shades of gray. And that's one of the very exciting things about fuzzy logic. And I think a lot of people kind of get turned on to it. It's a way in which they can, through technology, get a window on a different culture.
Japan's laboratory for international fuzzy engineering research, called LIFE, has an incredible board of directors. They are the presidents of Toshiba, Sumitomo Electronics, Nissan Motors, Nippon Steel, Minolta, Matsushita Electronics, and Fujitsu, to name just a few. Tell us about LIFE.
Okay. LIFE is a $70 million consortium, $70 million over 5 years, started in 1989 with about 50 companies, several of which you named, and now there's many more companies, and it's being renewed for the next 5 years. LIFE is an attempt to systematize fuzzy research in Japan, and to some extent it does that. Really what it is, Moira, is more the emblem of fuzziness in Japan. Fuzziness has been so popular in the different products, it doesn't need a LIFE. LIFE is sort of the what we call the epiphenomenon. LIFE came after the successes of Hitachi with the subway system and the fuzzy washing machines and camcorders and so forth. Japan tends to do this. It picks a new technology area, throws money at it. And I have spent some time at LIFE, and I have a lot of friends who work there. So in the West, it sort of scares us to see these big research centers put together, but I'm very skeptical of it. When I was there, you know, during the day, people, we talk technical, but the minute you hit the the beer bars at night. It was nothing but naked politics, and no company trusted the other, and they all rotated a few of their people through there, usually spying on seeing what the other people were doing. So I'm not convinced that sort of thing amounts to a heck of a lot of research. Again, most of the companies that sent people there already have ongoing fuzzy products, and they patent these, and the patent war is a very fierce one in Japan, and that's something they're not willing to share. And yet there is the group effort. There are some projects they have pursued. In the south of Japan, there is an alternative institute called FLSI, or the Fuzzy Logic Systems Institute, run by one man, Professor Takeshi Yamakawa, and this is on the island of Kyushu, the big island, the southmost island. And this is the competitor to LIFE. And if anything, this has helped put more blood into the LIFE program. And it's been interesting in my travels in Japan to see these two feuding entities. Now, to the west and to the outside, it looks like just two different fuzzy institutes, and they cooperate. But up close, it just looks like the utter chaos of war. And it's interesting because it's one man in the south who runs it versus an ever-shifting large bureaucracy in the north. And the one man in the south, I think, is holding his ground quite well.
It'll be interesting to watch all this in light of the new consortiums which are being supported by the technology initiative here in the United States.
Yes. So again, this is often evidence that we should do something, but one has to be very careful. In the early 1980s, the Japanese started their, quote, fifth generation project on artificial intelligence. They were going to make, in effect, smart computers the old way, the AI way, the symbol processing way, lots of black and white rules or decision trees. And it failed. And they didn't produce anything, and it quietly died, and the sixth generation is emerging, which is in effect their fuzzy neural technology. But in response to the apparent Japanese threat of an advance in artificial intelligence, we set up an alternative system through DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into our own computer science schools and artificial intelligence technology. And frankly, you don't have a heck of a lot to show for that either. In other words, you can't point to a product like a camcorder or a washing machine that depends in some way on this artificial intelligence technology. So I think we have to be very careful about these experiments in subsidized science.
You've proposed FAT, the Fuzzy Approximation Theorem. Tell us, what's FAT?
FAT is a theorem that says, again, that in theory we can replace any equation with a set of fuzzy rules. So it's another way to model scientific reality. In practice, what it means is when we try to model a system, something that turns inputs to outputs, that system defines a curve that wiggles. Now, how it wiggles isn't important, and we usually don't know how it wiggles, but just a picture in your head, think of something that wiggles, a blue curve that wiggles. And the fuzzy approximation theorem says that each piece of fuzzy knowledge is like a blue blob. And if you have enough of these blobs, you can always cover that wiggling curve. And if you have lots of little blobs, you can get a better cover. And so just intuitively, you can always have this cookie-cutter cover of something that wiggles. It's like putting a lot of napkins on a freeway or napkins on a snake or something. You can, in theory, always do that. And that shows that, in theory, a set of fuzzy rules can always approximate or learn or estimate any kind of system, anything that turns inputs to outputs, whether it's in physics or economics or whether it's in electrical engineering.
So you may not get precisely the answer, but you would at least sometimes get all of the answers.
Yeah, the theorem says that you could always pick an error level and always satisfy that. In other words, you can always find a set of fuzzy rules that approximate the system as accurately as you please. Now, that's in theory. How you find that takes us back to that question of where do you come up with the knowledge? And that's the open research area, and there's hundreds of different ways of trying to find the rules, and I'm sure there'll be thousands more.
Bart, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest today has been Bart Kosko. He is a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Southern California and author of the book Fuzzy Thinking, published by Hyperion. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.